Tonight, we have Kate Green, Carter Foster, and William Cordova here to present William Cordova Frameworks. Carter Foster is now the Deputy Director of Curatorial Affairs and Curator of Prints and Drawings at the Blanton in Austin, after having been the Curator of Drawings at the Whitney for some time. And in fact, if I understand correctly, Carter was the first Curator of Drawings at the Whitney. Is that correct?
First of all time.
Okay. All right. Okay. We don't want to deceive you. For tonight's purposes, Carter's claim to fame is that he acquired work by the artist William Cordova for the Whitney while there. That and the fact that he has a one-of-a-kind, the only tattoo ever designed by the artist Ellsworth Kelly on his forearm. So, he's done other stuff too, but I thought for the sake of brevity, I would just go straight to the really important stuff. Kate Green is a curator, an art historian, and an educator who, while director of Marfa Contemporary in Marfa, Texas, had the great wisdom of commissioning the artist William Cordova to create one of his dense, interconnected, and poetic installations as the last exhibition at Marfa Contemporary last year. She has since moved to El Paso, where she is curator at the El Paso Museum of Art, where I feel certain she is going to make the El Paso Museum a major destination. So from now on, people will be stopping by Marfa because they happen to be on a trip to El Paso. and we're just in close proximity, so why not? William Cordova, as you might have gathered, is the artist who brought us here tonight. He is described in his bio as an interdisciplinary cultural practitioner, and as such, he lives and works in Lima, Peru, Miami, and New York. He received a BFA from the School of Art of the Art Institute of Chicago and an MFA from Yale. His career has been interesting with significant exhibitions, residencies, and projects across the globe. For example, he has been represented by his work in the 2008 Whitney Biennial, the MoMA's PS1 Greater New York, Prospect 3 New Orleans Triennial in 2014, and the 12th annual Havana Biennial in 2015. And his work can be found in collections such as the Guggenheim, the Whitney, as we've mentioned, the Walker, the Museum of Art of Lima, and the list goes on. William's practice is based on research and engagement that results in poetic and explorative outcomes. So for those of you who know me, it will come as no surprise that I was immediately enamored with his exhibition, the exhibition I found at Marfa Contemporary last fall. And I was heartsick to learn that I had missed a conversation between the director of the space, the artist, and an art scholar who knew the work well, which is what led to the invitation to have a similar conversation here for Tuesday evenings. I'm very appreciative that all the players were willing to accept that invitation. So here we are. Please join me in welcoming William Cordova, Kate Green, and Carter Foster.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much, Terry, for the generous invitation and for visiting the exhibition in Marfa, for inviting us to kind of have a chance to come together again as we did at William's opening and think about this exhibition. Of course, at that time, we had just opened the exhibition. Carter was seeing it for the first time. You know, we were all seeing it for the first time. So it's a real pleasure to have the opportunity to think again and think together again about this exhibition. And since most of you, probably perhaps none of you besides Terry, have seen the exhibition, we thought we would begin by kind of walking y'all through the exhibition and then go back to looking a bit more in depth, perhaps talking a bit more in depth about certain pieces and references that arise. But for me, I mean, I think one of the most interesting things for me about working with William on this project and talking with Carter and others who've long engaged with his practice and talking with William is that there are so many directions to go with this work. So maybe I'll share a few of the directions, a few of the frameworks through which I've been thinking about William's practice as a whole, and in particular this project in Marfa, which involved elements, forms, and in fact some objects, as William often does, you know, revisits forms in new contexts to make them entirely new works. And so if you've followed William's practice, you very well might notice some forms or even specific objects that in other exhibitions maybe even had different titles and will appear again in William's upcoming exhibition at the Perez Art Museum in Miami that opens in April. A survey exhibition that I'm certainly looking forward to, but some of these forms will reappear. So for me, you know, it's interesting as I've talked with you and you about this project, you know, for me, as William and I talked about this, developing what we were going to do in Marfa, three things felt very evident and still feel very evident to me as kind of through lines through the exhibition, and three things that, in fact, I think have perhaps always overlapped in William's practice, I would maybe argue, and overlap in Marfa. Spiritualism, or the cosmos, another way, you know, a lot of people go to Marfa to, you know, gaze at the stars, and even if you don't, you are, you know, absolutely struck by the sense of the sublime, just being in that space and looking up. So whether it's whether you call it spiritualism or not, that kind of sense of, you know, being small in this giant place.
And the Marfa lights.
The Marfa lights. And Native American traditions, which feel very strong for some, maybe more than others in that area. But, you know, if you look, it is very evident. In fact, this form, this sculpture that we're looking at here, which we're walking into Marfa Contemporary here, and what you see formed, you know, if you flatten that form, it would be the kind of, now we're on the other side of that form or that sculpture, the kind of stepped pyramid pattern that you will see a lot in this exhibition, and you see kind of everywhere in Marfa if you start to look. So, for example, in the parapet of this building here, but kind of everywhere, and some pieces that William developed for the exhibition bring that out as well. And then, of course, references, I think all of these strands are evident even just in this sculpture, references to modern art, or specifically to minimalism. So, of course, the concrete forms that we associate with Judd or we associate with Marfa. And so all of these things kind of overlapping, I think, even in this specific piece. And then something that you and William, I know, have talked about a lot or share an interest in you know, references to popular culture that we see with this boombox form. And what is this boombox form? What it's a specific boombox, right?
Yeah. Sorry, I speak very low. So, yeah, it's not a random boombox that I selected. It's specific to a model from 1985 by Lasonic, which designed this particular model of boombox for the phenomenon of the rap music genre, hip hop, and more specifically, it was designed for breakdancing, even though by 1985, breakdancing, as we knew it in South Florida or in New York, was already passé. Now, in 1985, I also went to Houston, Texas for 6 months, as I mentioned earlier, in conversation. And then I saw kids in middle school b-boying, breakdancing. I thought, like, this is old. Because when you're 15, 6 months is a lifetime. And so I saw them, like, these people are not, you know, in the know. But all that aside, so Lasonic was a bit late in providing this type of large, oversized boombox, very cheaply made. When you turned the volume up too high, it wasn't very good. And it didn't last long, but they made different models. And but at the same time, it was my first boombox. It was my brother's first boombox. It was something we used to declare our space, or sonic space. And
they were everywhere in the culture at certain moments.
Yeah, there were much better ones. Yeah.
But I think that is interesting to me about choosing this model is it's, and I'm curious what you know, because you have this kind of long engagement with William's works on paper, in which boomboxes and other forms of tools for communication oftentimes.
Absolutely.
Appear. But I mean, that was what I thought was interesting about that you choosing this particular model, is that it was just after the wave. It was when it became mainstream. So really a tool of communication, and communication almost kind of across cultures, because it was no longer just kind of for an underground scene, but for a kind of wider audience. And I think that's something that I find weaving through your work too, is these kinds of distinct frameworks or ideologies or ways of thinking that we oftentimes think of quite distinct, that you weave together. So these kinds of vast territories are connected, and oftentimes kind of connected through tools of communication in various sorts, and often appearing boomboxes, records, antennae, often. And so I think those appear subtly in the show as well.
Yeah, a lot of themes in my work have a lot to do with transmissions.
Transmissions, right.
And you pick a lot of, like records are a big thing, and boombox here, obviously, but they're older technologies that, interestingly enough, are coming back in some cases, but they signify a different type of communicating in a way.
Yeah,
a
moment. That's interesting.
I see that technology I interpret it as sculptural, rather than virtual technology, which is all.
A record is sculpture in a way.
Of course, like three dimensional. It's also, it's data.
Yeah.
A record, as
a
data.
Holder of information.
Yeah, and so.
And rather profoundly complicated objects when you think about, they're obscure now. I mean, they're obsolete now maybe with digital, but incredibly difficult to make when you think about it.
Mm-hmm. And you make some too.
I make limited edition acetates, vinyl acetates, to record specific audio. Yeah. And that there's some in there.
Yeah, maybe we'll just kind of flip through some images just to give y'all a sense of the exhibition around which we can anchor. Thinking about your work. So you walked into Marfa Contemporary. It's a little hard to see in this image, but there was a wall behind that garage door. There was a wall. And you walked through the door behind here. So you couldn't see much from the windows, which was, something that William and I talked a lot about was, and I think you'll notice too, is something that I find throughout, your way of working and your work is making us work. Making us physically bend over, making us intellectually kind of go down roads, making us try to connect vast territories, do some research, try to figure out what these long titles mean, oftentimes involving multiple languages, the titles. And I think that's evident. I think that will be evident as we walk through as well. And so when you walked into the door, you saw this library of books, reference material that William, it was a collaboration between William and activist living in Marfa, who has an amazing collection of books through which William and he connected about, had a lot of kind of shared interests.
Sure.
What were some that struck you about Sandro's collection of books that we then had in the exhibition? Were there specific books or subjects that you were like, this makes sense to be here, or?
He had specifically newspapers that were published in Mexico in the late 70s, early 80s, and they were like underground newspapers, almost like how Rolling Stone magazine used to be published as an actual newspaper in San Francisco when it started back in 1966, and where it revealed things that were not necessarily in mainstream media.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't necessarily about music. So these newspapers that Sandro had were addressing architecture of necessity, how to make adobe, for people who may not necessarily, may have access to the materials, but may not know how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And just other very practical things in this newspaper kind of a how-to,
mm-hmm.
rather than, you know, without having YouTube,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
where they show you how to make things mm-hmm. that are really
mm-hmm.
practical.
Mm-hmm.
That newspaper operated that way.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so it was something that in Peru we didn't have.
Mm-hmm.
Just people passed it on. Not to say that in Mexico people were not passing it on, but this is also a way of maintaining a certain information
mm-hmm.
in
mm-hmm.
this hard copy
mm-hmm.
Version. And so the copies he had are sometimes the only copies left.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there might not be any more.
Mm-hmm.
And he's slowly digitizing them
mm-hmm.
and putting them up online
mm-hmm.
in the future.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what really struck me the most.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting because you mm-hmm. we were talking about doing a film series in Marfa that we didn't get a chance to do, but one of the films mm-hmm. that you were thinking about was a Cuban film about indigenous building practices, right?
Oh, that was...
Yeah.
There's
like a how-to film of like how to build your
yeah.
own... I don't even remember exactly.
Well, technically, it's a short 11-minute documentary by filmmaker Nicolas Guillen-Landrian, who was an Afro-Cuban experimental filmmaker, one of the first students to graduate post-revolution in 1962. And he was making these very short experimental films and gained a lot of attention really fast. In his young age, he was about 22, 23. And he was very prolific. He was censored a lot because this is during the infancy stage of the Cuban Revolution, the first 10 years. So it's very, very strict and very rigid parameters to work within. And so if you deviated from that or did anything, it might be interpreted as a challenge or as going against government policies. So he incorporated certain sounds and music. Some of it was from the Beatles music. And that was considered subversive. And so because it was from the West. It's not unique to Cuba. I mean, in Japan, they were doing the same thing. In Israel, they were doing the same thing, censoring these this type of music. So he was censored for a few years. And when they allowed him to go back and make films again, he did a film called To Construct a Building.
Mm-hmm.
But within this short documentary, he incorporates rhythms,
mm-hmm. oh, that's
Afro-Cuban
right.
rhythms, visually also,
mm-hmm.
visually with text and through just the physical forms of the workers moving around
mm-hmm.
and the way that he chopped up and edited the film.
Mm-hmm.
So people might look at it today and say, oh, well, there's nothing big about that. But back then it was actually a lot more revolutionary because films were not edited that way.
Mm-hmm.
You
mm-hmm.
know?
Yeah, and I think that rhythm... those rhythms are something. A rhythm is something that
mm-hmm.
I, you know, as we work together, I notice that is a kind of part of your way of working, and also you kind of washed over the show with. We'll get to it in a second.
Well, a lot of that is because I was pre-exposed to his Nicolas Guillen-Landrian's nephew of Nicolas Guillen, who was a Cuban poet and very well accomplished, and he actually developed this. This type of poetry where when you read it out loud, it has a certain rhythm that's trying to emulate drums,
mm-hmm.
African-Cuban drums. And the one that really did it for me was called Sensemaya. And so a lot of this material was available for us in Peru. And this is during the 70s and during also a different period in our country that was changed later on. And so we don't have that same type of education anymore, but I was pre-exposed to this.
Mm-hmm,
and so
mm-hmm.
that's why I gravitated to is, you know, Nicolas Guillen-Landrian, who is not well-known,
mm-hmm.
especially here or outside of Cuba,
mm-hmm,
until
mm-hmm.
around 2002.
Mm-hmm.
Some of his short films have been coming out.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So,
but, I mean, I think that kind of way of working is evident evident in the show, and I think also evident in the show, you know, which consists of the main space of the show, which was taken up by this 8-foot-tall scaffold-like structure that it forms the shape of a spiral. So as you can see, various pieces were kind of pressed against the sides of the wall. So what we might think of as like the art objects in the show were pressed against, in some cases, literally pressed against. This one, I think, was held up just by the pressure of the beams. I don't think it's even pinned to the wall.
I can't remember.
What
this,
piece?
This, the...
The record player?
The...
Oh, the gold.
The gold, yeah.
Piece. No, that was... I had a couple
of... Oh, that's the Howard Johnson's, right?
That's yeah, cool. The Howard Johnson's.
It was stapled.
Yeah, it was. Okay. But just to give us a sense, so we just, in terms of if you had experienced the show, you would have walked past this library here, then come into the main space, past a couple of pieces, small pieces installed around the sides of this series of walls, and this sculpture with a feather here. And I think I have, gives you a bird's eye view of the installation. About 3 dozen works, a mix of pieces that were made in Marfa and for the exhibition, and pieces that were kind of parts of previous iterations of works, and all variety of media. And as you can see, I know it's hard to see, but the titles here are quite lengthy and combine various languages. I think what oftentimes, even for me, I think certainly, what oftentimes kind of I skip over in my kind of desire to go down these rabbit holes of research that I like to go down with you, is your attention to material and to art, the kind of various layers in the objects themselves, and the art historical references, which I know is something that, you know, you have always engaged with.
And I think it's interesting that it gives you, there's, I don't want to say it's an aggression, but like you go in the space and you have to sort of figure out where to go.
Where to go.
You have to crawl under. Mm-hmm. I remember I had to crawl under the scaffolding. I'm a tall guy, so it was like, okay. To get to the next part of the exhibition. And you like giving these structured spaces in your work, because you've done things with, you've referenced architecture and other installations in it, and this is interesting because you're not pinned to the wall, but you're forced to
almost.
Kind of close,
I mean, you had like about we had like just ADA, you know, compliance,
right.
36 inches, I believe, around the perimeter here. I mean, this space is larger, but then as you turn the corner past this suite of, I think it's 10 collages, very recently done collages. Right. And kind of decide, do I pause? Do I look at these as objects? I mean, it kind of dislocated, certainly for me, and as in my observation, many viewers' experience was, do I contemplate each of these as objects? Do I go under? What is my, you know, how do I navigate this space? And, you know, and I think that's something that you've talked in interesting ways to me about. What, any thoughts on, like, you know, making things difficult for us?
Well, it's a relative. I think about these designs, like the spiral, it's influenced by sacred geometries and things that are organic or religious or spiritual. It can be secular, but the points of reference are sacred geometries. So what I wanted to do is kind of reactivate the way that individuals or groups experience spaces. Sometimes we become so complacent about the spaces that we go into every day, whether it's a supermarket, our home, a museum, or even a, you know, a mosque, a church, you know, a synagogue, and we don't necessarily pay attention too much anymore. So, limited to the museum space or the white cube, I wanted to redesign the space with this structure, this organically built, because it's made out of wood structure, and provoke people to, reconsider how they experience the visual work. So some of it is behind the scaffolding, like the yellow piece, or some of these pieces, there's not enough space for you to back up and see it clearly.
Dense shadows. I mean,
sure.
We talked about, you know, when we were lighting this, you know, wanting, used to museum practice, wanting to, you know, get rid of shadows, and you were happy with the shadows, and you know, making...
Well, I wanted to provoke intimacy also.
Does scaffolding and stacking have a symbolic...
Oh, yeah.
Meaning to you? Because you use it a lot.
Yeah, scaffolding's... I guess it depends on your background and where you are. Means so many different things. Like in the U.S., you won't see too many scaffoldings, or you might, if you see it in cities, they're usually veiled with nice viewer-friendly, Orange, or has Tyvek or some kind of company logo on it.
They put ads on it even sometimes.
Yeah, so that people don't see the construction, you know, the process of. But it's not so much in other countries where it's just work being done. I know some of it is veiled for protection so the dust doesn't get out. But for me, it's also about fluidity because in other places, the construction is constant. If something's constantly being taken down, something's constantly being taken up. And time and space differs a lot, whereas in Miami, for instance, last year, it only took 4 months to create this huge mega supermarket. 4 months. I would be scared to go in there because I'm thinking to get, you know, the permits passed for this in 4 months, you know, somebody got a lot of pocket in their money or money in their pocket. And so it might take 10 years for a structure to be built somewhere else for economic reasons, for other reasons. But time is also just interpreted differently, you know.
It symbolizes constant influx, temporary, but then if it continues, it's...
Yeah, it almost, like the spiral, it has a lot to do with infinity. So the spiral for me was that.
And instability, maybe to some degree, because it's there to shore things up. Mm-hmm. But and you're stacking something, it's also...
And like an opening, I mean, when I think about spiral, when I was reading about spiral, it's like a kind of... endlessly opening and closing at the same time. Both are happening, and in some ways, you know, scaffold is like a building and then an ending, and you know, a kind of constant in that sense.
The Guggenheim Museum, the spiral.
It's
all in there.
I think of the term. I was writing down adjectives that just I thought described your work earlier today, and like rickety came up in my head because I was looking at something you drew, and it was this rickety looking thing that's
fragile.
Fragile. Mm-hmm.
I mean, that to me, I think about your like. Some of the art historical references, but I think we have images of some. We can come back to some of these, but
it's alluding to that type of fragility. The fragility is in the content of the components around that scaffolding.
Mm-hmm.
So,
say that again?
I can't.
But then sometimes we talked about this the last time. The use of gold is really interesting to me, too, because that symbols a kind of more permanence as something that's valued in a certain way.
I'm interested in alchemy.
Yeah.
Magical transformations.
Yeah.
The boombox could be part of, you know, that alchemy, how it changed and how it's interpreted through pop culture now.
When you use gold, do you actually use real gold leaf, or do you...
No,
it's too expensive.
Can we get back to a full screen view? Thank you.
No, it's not because it's expensive, but it's
hard
about
to work
transforming
with.
Something that doesn't necessarily, that, you know, economically is not worth that much.
Right.
It's just
because mutation. When you'll put something that's very thought of as like a segment of graffiti on gold ground. So it's this, you know, graffiti's thought of as like something that goes with urban decay and...
Mm-hmm.
That kind of thing, and gold is thought of as this, it brings something up. And I love that.
Yeah, historically, graffiti is always seen as that, you know, urban decay, ghetto. There's always a lot of shame implied to it.
Yeah. It's interesting how that's changed, though, because look at...
Well, when the early 80s, when Keith Haring and Kenny Scharf, all these artists
Lee
started
Quinones,
to get their degrees at SVA, then it became something else. There's money to be made in there.
Yeah, right.
But specifically, the references that I make are usually historical individuals who are pioneering this type of artwork and from the early 70s.
Yeah. Such as in this piece here, which was, so then now we're kind of entering, we've just like rounded this corner, gone past this room with a video of a beach in Peru that kind of washed over in terms of sound and light over the whole installation. I kind of thought of it as a moving sculpture. That's how it shaped the exhibition for me. And then once you went past that, you could choose to go under. You needed to go under if you wanted to go any further. There was no entrance. So if you wanted to go, if you wanted to experience more of the exhibition, you needed to go under. And also look up. You needed to look up too. There were works installed on a kind of second story, so to speak, and Those all drawings in cacao.
Do you want to talk any about those drawings that were, there were six of them in the exhibition installed, in, or maybe eight? No, six, yeah.
Sure. But I should add.
Yeah.
I don't know if the audience is getting a proper interpretation of what this installation may have looked like, but there's a lot of components. Are you all familiar with 2001, A Space Odyssey? Mm-hmm. Yeah? Enough people?
Yeah.
Okay. Got a witness up there. Okay. I saw it when I was 14 the first time. I did a lot of extensive reading before I saw it, because I usually do that just out of trauma. That's another story. And so I watched it and over and over and over. And it took me a long time to figure out and to experience the film in all its layers. It was like an artichoke, you know, you have to peel it away. And so these installations that I create often take a lot of interpretations, but you have to visit it many times.
Like an onion, just so many layers, or
yeah,
spiral, or a galaxy with a lot of stars. Or
sure, sure. But in general, my work is that way.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's always a lot of layers to a lot of the topics that I'm investigating,
mm-hmm.
A lot of entry points.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not intentionally done to confuse people or to make it difficult at all. It's just a lot more involved, yeah. And sometimes you can come and see one piece, and I don't think there's an example, but there's sometimes I draw things, you know, really well, so that it's you can have a nice introduction to the work, while other pieces might be more abstract.
Mm-hmm.
So I go back and forth.
And there's a real contrast and richness of materials that's usually used. Both it could be in an individual drawing or work, and within a show like this, where it's individual experiences of looking at like something that's more or less flat,
mm-hmm.
and then having to circumnavigate something.
Listen,
watch, some people engage more with mm-hmm. materials, other people with just the visuals.
Mm-hmm.
The cacao drawings, it's cacao from Peru, and the designs, well, there's no examples of designs, but...
I think we have some. There's a couple you can see well, but these are not the ones. Are you thinking about the ones that are based on Tiwanaku architecture? Is that what you mean?
Well, it's all interrelated. I was trying to create this intersection between Frank Lloyd Wright, the architect's designs, furniture, and the Roby House, and the furniture in the Roby House, as well as the windows, and the Tiwanaku from Bolivia architecture, and also just Andean architecture in general, also Maya and Japanese. That influenced Frank Lloyd Wright.
Mm-hmm.
So there's all these intersections. Depending on what you're informed by in your background, you might come in and say, oh, that's Frank Lloyd Wright. Somebody else might say, oh, that's Tiwanaku. And might not know who Frank Lloyd Wright is. So, but we're all meeting in the same place. But we don't have proper examples.
Yeah, we do. We do. Hold on. we have, let's see.
Here there you go.
So okay. Here's a pair of the of two of the
cacao drawings.
Cacao drawings, and then some of the references that you were just mentioning.
Right. This
for
is,
example.
Yeah. This is Puerta del Sol, Sun Portal. So some of the drawings come from that.
And also, you know, I thought this was really interesting when when you first visited Marfa and we went to Judd's, you had been doing these cacao drawings for some time,
mm-hmm.
and thinking, among other things, about these courtyards at Tiwanaku.
Right.
And then knew when William and I began talking about doing something in Marfa, you had already done research about Judd and his interest,
mm-hmm.
and knew when we went to the block. So this is now we're in, this is Donald Judd's essentially like his domestic compound in Marfa.
And he manipulated or changed some buildings and the spaces. One, there's, they tightly control images, so it's hard to get good images of this, but it's, this is a courtyard that he created with adobe walls. He had adobe makers in Marfa, artisans, create this courtyard that you learned or you researched before mm-hmm. you even got to Marfa long ago, that he too was interested in Tiwanaku architecture, right? Or Andean architecture, or...
Specifically, Tiwanaku Inca mm-hmm. architecture mm-hmm. that he was studying at Columbia University.
So these very same kind of spaces that yeah. you had been looking at.
Right.
Such as this.
And then he basically emulated the same courtyard mm-hmm. in Marfa. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but he used adobe. These are stone.
Mm-hmm. And you've dealt with this issue of like taking an object that's used in one context culturally mm-hmm. and it migrating to a different culture and being used in a different way, and it's fascinating.
Yeah, I think it was incorporated for the same reasons.
You mean he?
He was
also, you know, he was doing, are you kind of saying he was doing a similar kind of remixing? As
yeah. Or just think about the issue of language and how that, you know, like mm-hmm. an object's called one thing and mm-hmm. it's used for one thing, and then mm-hmm. you change the context and it's the same object mm-hmm. and it's used in another way. Because mm-hmm. there's that, yeah. is it a drum or something that you've used in your work? I can't remember that.
The cajon?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, the cajon, which is a drum, an Afro-Peruvian drum, which looks very similar to speakers from the 70s or to early 80s.
Right.
Wooden stat speakers.
So say yeah. this... Like yeah, the form that we're looking at here.
Yeah.
Which is a sculpture of yours, an installation of yours from the early aughts called Machu Picchu. Or
Machu Picchu
called
After
different
Dark.
Things. Yeah.
That's good. That's good to know.
Yeah. And so, yeah, when I was a child, I would see them in the U.S., and I thought there were people throwing away drums because mm-hmm. they were just tossing these out, and they would take out the, you know, the speaker itself. Mm-hmm. And so... later on, I started collecting about 200 of them, created this piece.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah. Also, like the idea of the discarded seems to have a lot of interest for you. And,
yeah, we don't discard things in Peru. We just reuse them for something else. Uh-huh. We've been recycling for the last 400 years.
So. We have a lot to learn from you. That's good.
Well, yeah. There's no detail to this, no?
Of this particular piece?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. Okay.
What were you wanting to look at?
The ephemera on the side.
Yeah, I know, yeah. It's too bad. There's not... This is this material here that William's talking about.
There are just different components, some texts, some vinyl jackets alluding to the piece, mm-hmm. just completing the piece more, informing it more. Mm-hmm. It's not a piece... It's a sonnet drum, in a way. Mm-hmm. It's not a piece that you listen to anything.
For me, it also almost seems like a steely, or like it also has a kind of... a kind of the gravity of
definitely.
Like a pilgrimage site, yeah. and you know, like Machu Picchu is for many.
Well, then yeah. you know, it goes up like this. It's mm-hmm. got a solid.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, it's based on a burial mound,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and it's based on the Afro-Peruvian drum. Mm-hmm. So there is that Andean African mm-hmm. mix in that piece.
With these almost like offerings.
Yeah, yeah,
mm-hmm.
yeah, yeah.
So these were. This is in, you know, and again, like William was talking about the various references that he was interested in and in creating this exhibition. And this is for those of you who haven't been in the inside of a room in Judd's compound. So you know these various traditions that William is interested in Judd to, amongst many others, right? Of course. Mm-hmm. And here's some other images of other references that have been important to you. That appear in your work, and maybe the first, perhaps the most important, I think this image kind of references a lot of strands that reappear in your work, to me.
Yeah, this,
like
this
building,
is...
building, family...
Yeah, this is things in flux.
Mm-hmm.
It's an intervention. This functions as a photograph, where I just went and I made a concrete boombox, and I inserted a book inside of it, and then I left it out here with a Peruvian gourd, in not a random place, but a historical space that was being reconstructed
in Miami.
Yeah,
Miami?
In Miami, the writer Eldridge Cleaver lived there for about 2 years back in 1995, 96. And I used to listen to his radio show in Miami back then. And so this house was being gutted out. So I found out about it and I decided to leave the boombox there with a poetry book inside. I don't know what happened to the boombox, but I photographed the piece, and so the piece is actually just a photograph. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So now it's probably finished now. It's about 2 years ago.
What about your relationship to mark making? Let's get to say it in a major piece like this, or I think we have images of some. Well, here's another large collage, but then we don't have any close-ups of these suite of 10. But on small and large scale, this relationship to mark making and the forms that appear again, or, you know, I don't know if there are certain things that...
I think the large ones are more meditative for me. Mm-hmm. They take a lot longer. I don't make large works as much, at least 2D works. They usually take, like, 2 to 4 years sometimes.
Your drawings often have on the smaller scale, often have this, you know, great contrast between a highly skilled line and delicate rendering of something, and then it'll be on like a used stained piece of paper or something, but then maybe and another one maybe has gold leaf. The contrast of these many different materials and mediums in one thing has always been really interesting.
Yeah, I tend to reclaim materials rather than go to the art supply store.
Yeah. And it gives it a very specific feel. It's very... you feel the weight of, like, use and history.
Yeah,
and, like, something. Like, and you create a space where that becomes meaningful. Like, the oil stain that was there becomes, you know, you read it in terms of whatever else is on the sheet.
Yeah, I'm definitely interested in reactivating that or highlighting those things because it is part of that material. And so, for me, it's not so much about erasing at all, but provoking further investigation as to why it was left there. Mm-hmm. You know, I might have an intervention or sometimes a collaboration with stains or marks that were there already to kind of appreciate that those marks or that history. And
also creating a kind of world around them. I mean, on a large scale, you know, you can think about this feels like a universe, a constellation, a kind of world alive with vectors.
And it's very alive in the space because it projects out in the space. It's not framed or glazed. It's like very much, and you want to touch it even though you're not supposed to.
Mm-hmm. And this in particular is the support, the physical support of this one is a series of old maps that you've kind of intervened on and then even, you know, put additional materials onto. On a smaller scale, though, too, this suite of 10, and I thought that was an interesting thing that came out, I believe it was in a conversation between you two, maybe it was you and Robert Pruitt, was this kind of deep dive into other worlds, you know, through sci-fi or through your, you know, relationship to reading or, you know...
Some of the smaller ones are...
Those kinds of worlds, but I think on small and large scale, you create those in your graphic works, which is really interesting. And I think that has something to do with this reuse of materials. Like, you capitalize upon this previous use to kind of create this world.
Well, I started... a lot has to do with the isolation, being displaced, growing up in Miami in the 80s. What I gravitated to in order to not go insane was to read comic books and read a lot of science fiction. And so that's how I balanced my, you know, my everyday. And then after that, when you read enough, you look at enough, you also want to do it. So I started doing comic books, and I was doing, I don't know, like 4 or 5 different comic books a day for about 6 years. And... you know, you gain a certain discipline, and you develop your writing skills, your drawing skills. And so a lot of the smaller drawings, these are kind of influenced by that. You don't see that directly anymore, but it's there. That's the type of conversation that we were having at Marfa.
Do you think your tendency to work serially to some degree is influenced by that, looking at comic books and that kind of like... box-to-box-to-box type of thing.
Yeah, it has that structure.
Yeah.
And then these bigger arcs, too, you know, that there's such through lines between, you know, from one project to the next. So, like, you sometimes work in, create a series, but then also, you know, all of your work seems to be a series in a way.
Sure, yeah. I saw that you had some images by Basquiat. What's that for?
Oh, just because. Why not?
Okay.
Just one.
Glenn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good old Glenn. Mm. But I think, you know, one of the things that's coming out as you're talking is this kind of pivoting between, you know, old and new materials, worlds, and
high
I think
low.
That's high-low, you know, and creating a your own universe with all of that. And I think that's something that is interesting to me, and I just wanted to point out one other part of the project which I think points to that, or one other part of the project in Marfa which points to that, which was this series of concrete spheres that existed. Not only they were made, this image is just because they were made through some workshops that we did in Marfa with people in Marfa, but these concrete spheres that existed on the top of the scaffold, creating the shape of a Big Dipper with a few extra stars combined. And then also the same spheres or group of spheres were out in Marfa at locations in Marfa that those of you who are familiar with Marfa might know that, you know, Marfa is historically quite segregated along a number of lines. And so these spheres, at least theoretically, connected places that would otherwise be quite disconnected and connected inside of Marfa Contemporary with outside of Marfa Contemporary. And so that, I think, is something, this kind of connection, transmission, communication to create another world is something that I find kind of really runs throughout your work.
Yeah, there's also the scaffolding. You could go through it, but because of the height, you couldn't see the top of it unless you were a bird looking down through the skylight. And that was intentional because I wanted to create a piece that wasn't necessarily for everybody to experience directly. The constellation that you had up there where we created these concrete spheres and we placed them in different locations throughout Marfa was very strategic because we placed them in locations where there's that, which is about having where people come together, have exchanges like the local library, the barber shop, the radio program.
Cemetery.
Yeah, the cemetery. Places like that. And I think it's still up, no?
Some of them. Some of them, yeah. But I thought one of the sweetest ways that you articulated why you chose certain sites was that places where elders imparted information to others in the community. I thought that was an interesting way of thinking about spaces and thinking about public spaces.
Well, it has a lot to do with the way that I grew up and who I was constantly around and who, you know, who were the wise ones in the family or in the community. And those type of experiences and lessons that I learned, I've always gravitated to that and still do. So I find that to be very important, and also in my practice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Transmission of information. Speaking of transmitting information, maybe this is a good time for us to. Did you have a question or thought on your lips?
No.
Yeah, that you want to. Be a good time to see what thoughts have arisen for others here. Questions. Please, Terry.
To begin with, and I hope everybody can hear this, I am so blown away and I feel so cheated because I did not spend enough time. I feel like I saw a fraction of the exhibition being in it, which is both, I mean, that's part of the appeal. Like, I know I didn't get it all, which makes me kind of love it all the more. And that takes me to a kind of passing comment you made, William, about intimacy in the space. And if I understood maybe what might read to someone else as creating obstruction, so that you, but and you, but if I understood, you actually saw that as creating intimacy.
Correct. Yeah, I often tend to do that when I install works that might seem really aesthetically stimulating, rather than just place it in the front so people walk in, look, and then move on. I'll put something in. I might mount it much lower to the ground or much higher.
You can just see things on the floor.
Just to slow down the way that people read artworks. Because sometimes I'll go to an institution, they already have a preconceived idea what the height should be. And that's okay.
57 center.
Exactly. And so I tend to just lower them a little more or put them in places that you won't necessarily consider should be the proper space. Not to be disobedient, but just to slow down how we navigate just through life, you know, because we're kind of always on the go. And we may not experience or see something because, I mean, I see a lot of people don't even look at the sunset in the morning because they're typing. And that's fine, but sometimes we have to pause.
And it means so much when we catch something in our periphery, like even in our everyday. Like somehow we have a relationship with that thing that we almost miss. And that's the feeling I get from this installation.
And a lot of the themes in the work have a lot to do with erasure, marginalized histories or individuals. And so sometimes when an individual actually takes the steps and finds something on their own, they can own that experience and value it a lot more. And so that's a lot of reasons why I do
it. If you look at the drawing with the, I believe it's a Howard Johnson's, right?
Right.
That you had to, it kind of forced you to be up against that drawing when you were in there, and it made you feel it in an intimate way, and that you wouldn't have if you felt like you had to be back. And it almost gave you permission to do that.
So, I mean, I think when we were talking about this piece, installing this piece, William, you said you wanted to stick it somewhere where people couldn't, like, take selfies with it. You know, that this is arguably the piece that people want to stand back. You know, it's how many feet wide?
5 by 7.
So, you know, a traditional hang of this piece would be to give it, you know, its own huge wall, you know, pride of place, a lot of space, and you did the exact opposite, you know, and made us go close, you know, made us kind of, and you couldn't see it all, and I think that speaks to what you were saying, Terry, is literally, you know, you can't with your work, which makes it all the more compelling. I agree that, you know, I could keep thinking and writing about this forever and find new ways to think about it, that it doesn't ever close for me. You know, it's kind of an infinitely expanding universe in that way for me.
But it's also not the only way that I would present a piece. You know, it also depends on the place and the time.
So have you presented this, say, particular piece as an object that it can, you know, gets its own wall? And
Yeah, I have. A little bit of background. It was Howard Johnson's. A lot of Howard Johnson's buildings, the architecture is designed by Rufus Nims, who actually lived in Miami and was one of the first architects to design and build basically baby boomer homes out of concrete. So a lot of them in North Miami, and he retired and lived there. But there's something in the roof of this building that he designed that doesn't seem to have any actual use, you know, no, or actual function. They're like bunkers that he created. And that was something I was also interested in. Yeah.
And they used to be everywhere. Now they...
And this one is ruins. Just kind of floating. It has again, like a stack of records here. Almost another little, you know, reliquary in a way, or a spot to kind of pay homage to.
It's ephemera that contextualizes the piece,
the
more.
Research,
The research, the structure.
And then what's this floating in the sea of gold?
It's a radio with a piece of wood.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Transmission across territories.
Yeah, something like that.
Information.
Yeah.
Set off in the sea of gold.
Yeah. There's no stream of consciousness. It's very specific, but we don't have a detail of it, so I won't elaborate.
Okay. Yeah.
Can you talk about the constellation orbs, the concrete ones that you were making with the group of people?
Right. That was, we created a constellation of the Big Dipper.
Right. So when it's installed, they kind of look like in, correct me if I'm wrong, mm-hmm. they look like they were being cast out of like tennis balls,
yes.
Okay. So, yeah. So I kind of got that before I even saw the tennis balls mm-hmm. being used, because it feels like this sun-bleached, like, tennis ball in the yard that you find. So I'm getting this vibe that there's, like, this kid up here, you know, throwing the tennis ball against the wall and making those crazy imprints on them. So, yeah, you're creating this very intimate space that we can't access. But it's like a... Because I'm assuming nobody could get up there.
Right.
Although, yeah. I'm sure, did people try?
No, people, because people treated, but for the most part, people treated the scaffold as if it were an object. People generally, I mean, people would say, like, during events, people would lean on it a bit, but people kind of mm-hmm. treated it as an art object. Not that we said it was. It was certainly, we kind of had to, like, nudge people to engage. You know, people's first instinct was to, you know, walk around the exterior and not be sure how to engage with the you know, structure. Yeah.
Yeah. But so this is the interior version, and then there's the exterior version, which is throughout Marfa itself, repeating the same constellation.
Were they small or large?
They were a little bit smaller than, it's about...
Same size.
They were yeah. the
same size. Same, this same exact way. Same sphere. So we cast all of them in this workshop,
mm-hmm.
and then they were placed, some of them placed inside and some of them placed outside.
Yeah, yeah. And the public was invited to make them themselves and bring something personal. Some people use it as an ingredient. And so some people brought hair, locks of hair, or a little bit of dirt from their yard, things like that.
Poems.
Like
letters. And I think that, you know, spoke in interesting ways to me about your relationship to building and building in your family. You talked about, you know...
What people
do with building and how it's invested. And that's certainly a big conversation in Marfa, mm-hmm. is the investment of certain materials with kind of symbolic power, like adobe in particular in Marfa. And so that kind of played into this piece and your background as well.
Yeah, my uncle was a contractor and an architect and built all the family homes. So when he was doing construction work, he would often incorporate, you know, his gloves or shoes into the mix and leave it there. And I always found that interesting. So sometimes I tend to incorporate literature. I'll put it in a Ziploc bag and then incorporate it. Yeah. Yes, sir.
I have a two-part question. One is, Carter and Kate, you both have had different experiences with William, curatorial and in the acquisition process. Could you talk a little bit about that dynamic in each experience? And in particular, I'm curious about what that curatorial dialogue was in Marfa.
Well, it's pretty easy in my case because I didn't know him. I met him much later, actually.
So much easier in that
case. But I saw his work and thought it was, I thought it was great, and I worked to acquire it for the Withing, and I did that three times, I think. So, and I
did
don't
you
think
know him over the course of this?
I didn't. No, I think we met when we did that thing with Leslie Hewitt,
right?
Sycamore Jenkins, mm-hmm. and that was the first time I believe we met.
Yeah, that was the first time.
So I just interpreted all my own without his help.
What did your colleagues?
People admired his work, and we kept doing it. I mean, I was head of an acquisition committee, or I ran an acquisition committee for the Whitney, and I kept bringing his work back, because at the Whitney, we like to collect in depth if we, you know, and he'd been in a biennial, so there was a lot of context there. And I thought, I thought and still do that he had a really innovative approach to drawing, the materials of drawing, and the conceptual approach to drawing, which I just found fascinating. So that's why I thought it was important to bring to the collection.
And William and I go back quite a while. I mean, I guess my first engagement with William's work was visiting you when you were at the Corps, when I was working at a different museum years ago, when I was at Art Pace, and did a studio visit, and I remember thinking quite distinctly that, I felt like you were running circles around me intellectually, and I didn't know kind of how to navigate that space, I remember, in the studio visit. And I also remember feeling really drawn to the way you were working with materials and a kind of sacred, a sense of the sacred or the sublime in the space. And I didn't really know what to do with that. I was really intrigued, and I kind of it just stayed with me. And an opportunity didn't arise at that time, but it really stayed with me. And then I don't know. Did we just reconnect after I was in Marfa and really wanted to explore doing something together?
Yeah, I think so. We met about 11 years ago.
Yeah.
And then reconnected.
Yeah. And then and the process was, you know, as it is in many such cases, really began with, are you interested? You know, what do you think about Marfa? Do you want to do something? Do you have thoughts? Does it arise for you? What could you imagine doing here? I really wanted to do something that would be specific to that context and true to William's practice as well, and then began with a studio site visit and then just conversations, you know. Mm-hmm. And William knows what he's doing and knows what he wants to do and will let me pressure him, but also has a really strong idea of where, you know, literally kind of where things should go or the direction something should take, but also really quick to pivot. If you know, I express something, I really think this would be an interesting path to explore something. I remember you being kind of very sensitive to that too. So it was really generative for me, you know, intellectually and kind of the back and forth, while also really watching your process that is so strong in and of itself.
You had a question, sir?
I was going to say part two was... Sorry, I'm just going to dominate this whole question. The more for William, in this case, because the piece in Marfa, I mean, we're looking at the Marfa installation mostly, right? It feels very intentional, the placement in that curatorial vision or the artistic vision, as though you've created a world there in that site. And at a higher level, what it feels like to me, and just listening to you talk and the dialogue, that you're imparting your wisdom in a certain way. That's what it feels like to me. And there's an element of healing. And that's again just my impression. I just thought, wanted to throw that back towards you and say, does that resonate with you as well?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, definitely. Healing has a huge part of my installation work, transcending. When I evolved as a visual practitioner in school, undergrad, and between that and grad school, I tended to do works where sometimes I would make comments or state certain topics that didn't have a way home, didn't have a way out. They weren't necessarily about healing. I was just going through a certain motion. And it should also be about healing. It should be about something else. It should transcend. It should be have certain closures.
Transformative?
Yeah. Otherwise, I'm just going around in circles with a wound that will never heal. And I needed to allow that to also function in a different level, different way, so that the viewers can come in and not necessarily feel that weight, but also use it as a key to navigate somewhere else themselves. So I think it's a huge factor in my work overall. Yeah. Thank you for asking that and picking up on that. I should add that everything, I think about 99% of the work that you saw, except for the scaffolding, my practice devolved in art residencies because I wanted to extend my studio practice after graduating from this intense two-year grad program. And I saw a lot of the students who graduated before me move to New York or some other large city, and they needed to get a job, they needed to reposition themselves in society, and it was very difficult. So a lot of them were not able to get back to their practice for a year or a year and a half, and within that time, they lost focus. And it happens. I didn't want that to happen, so I thought, what if I go from grad school to an art residency program? So I did that. I planned it. Let's try it for 2 years, I thought, and ended up becoming 10 years. And I was able to just to flow from one to the other, back to back. And there's a sacrifice behind that, but when that's all I was focused on, you know, I didn't have any other obligations at that time, and so I was able to do it for that long. And
takes you out of the commercial process a little bit, which I would think would be a good thing.
Yeah, because then it show it, it
in teaching.
You see it in the work. Yeah, and I didn't teach, not because I don't value it. I just simplified my life to the most basic thing and lived in the studio. Squatting in the studio and even in grad school. So I tend to produce a lot more work slowly, but I do it because I didn't have a lot of obligations. And sometimes I propose that to students who are about to graduate, that they at least give art residencies an opportunity, because it will affect the way you think and also the amount of space that you utilize mentally and physically.
It's interesting because it makes your shows feel like a studio. I mean, they feel more like an artist studio than a typical gallery. It's not bump, bump, bump. It's like
this
thing that you do what you want with.
Yeah. Though my studio is a lot messier, but yeah.
And you have a lot of confidence in that space.
True. True.
So can I pick up on that theme of doing art residencies? Because to do those, you have to write, obviously, a persuasive application. So I'm wondering now, because we haven't seen, like, you know, the traditional artist statement, but the role writing might play in your practice, even though I haven't heard you refer to it, but you must be having to articulate it someplace to put forward these applications.
When I was much younger, I started writing, I think like when the internet really kicked off, or when I took notice of it, about 98, I started writing reviews, music reviews, on albums that I liked online. And so there was no pressure to be like this great academic. And so I would just write, and I would do it almost every day. And when you do it that much, you get better at writing, and you start trying to refine it better. And then I started reviewing art books and stuff like that. Not for anyone, just like Amazon.com and things like that. You do that for a while when you're not in school, you get really good at it, and you start writing other things. So I used that, I realized that I was exercising. And I mean, I had written short stories and stuff like that before and read a lot of poetry, but this is different writing. And so when I was about to graduate, then of course I had to write in school about things that I didn't necessarily want to write about, but I had to. But I also realized that after writing for so long, you just turn it on. And so when I had to write artist statements or proposals, letter of intent for residencies, it wasn't that difficult, you know, and so I'm able to just apply it because I'm always doing it. And I'm still writing reviews. But I think that's also a way for students to not be so hesitant to write about art, to write about something you like, something you're really, really passionate about, and just exercise it. And then when you have to, it's not that difficult. It's just like exercising for anything. And so yeah, you know, I update my artist statement all the time, tweak it a lot, but I don't know if there's any students here, but there is a certain formula to apply to also to art residencies, and kind of realize that early on. So
we have to pay extra for you to tell us what.
No, he will provide you with copious notes, I can attest.
if you send him
something. No, I usually share that every time I speak to students when I get invited to universities. I just tell them to reach out. There's steps you take. The first thing is to how to document your work. Never document your work as if it looks like it's coming from a Sears catalog, where you isolate the image, because some students have gigantic paintings that are the size of this entire building, and then they crop everything, and when you project it, you can't tell what the scale is. And a lot of times it has to do with scale. And if you can't tell that, how do you contextualize it? So I share images of my work. I always document my own work. And so when I give presentations, I show them and then I, walk them through it as to why I documented it this way, why I framed it this way, why it's so important to document everything you do, whether it's resolved or not. And, not necessarily so you can become a savvy artist, but you just prepare yourself for, people prepare night and day before they go on Disney vacations. But oftentimes, they don't prepare for their career right before they're about to graduate from grad school, especially in the visual arts, because they don't really inform us very well in grad programs, in studio practices. So that's something I try to provide, because I didn't have that. And so if it's information I have and can share, then I'm willing to do that. Yeah. But I'm always open to giving more information about that. Yeah.
If there aren't any other questions, because I don't want to cut anybody off, I think we'll call it a night, but I just want to confess that this might have been one of the most selfish acts of my life. This was solely for me, and clearly it paid off for everybody here. So congratulations. You get to say you were here. This is one of those special nights, I think. I appreciate it so much.
Thank you.